This year's Oscar nominations were dominated by two very different films, the biopic nuclear bomb epic Oppenheimer and the fantastical and theatrical Shelley Frankenstein-inspired Poor Things. Now, there aren't many crossovers between the two stories or cinematic structures, impressive though they may be, except for the use of black and white. While the first color film was created in 1914, for 50 years, movies and television were primarily shot in black and white due to the painstaking and expensive process of color film. It wasn't until Kodak developed a more affordable Eastman color film in 1950 that the shift in visual media was enlightened by color. That's why the turning point of the black and white era is best symbolized in 1942's The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy transitions from the black and white world of Kansas to the brightly colored world of Oz.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
The film was a poster board of the dramatic effect color versus black and white could provide audiences. So, why after 80 years since color film's invention, are we still using black and white? What makes our greatest directors, photographers, and social app filters resort to the two-tone spectrum when the possibilities of color are endless to what our human pupils can see? You're listening to a podcast called Least Important Things. I'm your host, Luke Ferris. Last year, I watched a film that changed me. And it's been out for 75 years. The Third Man is set in post-war Vienna and follows a down-on-his-luck American pulp writer who unravels the mysterious plot of his believed-to-be-killed friend, Harry Lime. Now, like most impotent cinephiles, The Third Man had been on my Letterboxd watch list for years, and it wasn't until I watched Richard Ayoade's Travel Man episode in Vienna that I decided to commit to watching it.
So this is where Orson Welles refused to come when he was making The Third Man.
Whenever you see his face, he was here.
Right.
Whenever you see his back or just his feet, it wasn't Orson Welles.
Okay, good old Orson. So how long does this tour last?
Minimum of 5 hours.
Okay. Well, quick as you like, let's wrap it up.
I was stunned by the freshness of the cinematography. The shadows of the damp night streets of Vienna and the plucky score had a tonal pull on my spirit, especially this specific shot that uses shadows to reveal, spoiler alert, that Harry Lime is indeed alive.
Step out in the light and let's have a look at you. Who's your boss?
Sag's, was wollt denn Ihnen überhaupt ein? Sind Sie deppert? Ja, Sie meine ich. Schauen Sie so blöd. Eine Frechheit ist das, mitten in der Nacht so einen Krawall zu machen.
Harry!
For weeks, I couldn't get The Third Man out of my head. I'd walk down the alleys of my Chicago neighborhood listening to the score, pretending I was Holly Martins in a drunken stupor. It was like a schoolboy crush, where you can't stop thinking about why that girl didn't text you back. Or like hearing Taylor Swift songs in every retail building you walk into. To fuel my obsession, I bought this book by Taschen, which is a publishing company who makes these amazing, gorgeous coffee table books, and I've been delving into the noir genre ever since. But while simultaneously saturating myself in this era, I also noticed that the movies I was watching in the theater had a similar look. Black and white. Here's a clip from the Taschen book, Film Noir. The visual look of film noir can be traced from the street paintings of Edward Hopper and Reginald Marsh to the grisly crime photos of Weiji. Simply put, what most viewers notice when watching a noir movie are chiaroscuro lighting. Low-key lighting in the style of Rembrandt or Caravaggio marks most noirs of the classic period. Shade and light play against each other, not only in night exteriors, but also in dim interiors, shielded from daylight by curtains or Venetian blinds. Hard, unfiltered sidelight and rim light outline and reveal only a portion of the face to create a dramatic tension all of its own. Now, the use of black and white as film or a filter has come in waves of popularity. Directors in the 70s used black and white as an homage to their early childhood experiences with black and white pictures, like David Lynch's Eraserhead, Woody Allen's Manhattan, and Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein. In the 90s and 2000s, black and white came roaring back thanks to the wide use of digital editing software that allowed you to click a black and white filter over a color image. That's why there are so many music videos from the era that incorporate black and white, as well as my shitty video projects made on iMovie that I hope will never see the light of day. Filmmakers started committing to entire projects in black and white, like Schindler's List, Sin City, Nebraska, The Artist, or Frances Ha.
Tell me the story of us.
Again? We are gonna take over the world.
You'll be this awesome publishing mogul.
And you'll be this famous modern dancer.
Director Noah Baumbach said in an interview with fellow director Peter Bogdanovich for Criterion that he shot Frances Ha in digital with a black and white edit because, quote, it kind of evoked film, but looks like something new.
I asked you to move in with me. You said no.
But I can't.
You can. You don't want to.
And today, black and white is coming full circle by reverting back to its origins in physical film. In 2019, David Eggers' psychological horror timepiece, The Lighthouse, shot on Kodak XX 35mm film. The director of cinematography, Jaron Blaschke, said in a Hollywood Reporter article that he was using square frame film to give the movie a more, quote, unique signature that you can't get in any other way.
Keeping secrets, are you?
No, sir.
Watch you spill your beans.
Oscar-winning director of cinematography Hoyt Van Hoytma had an even greater challenge than the team from The Lighthouse on the film Oppenheimer.
But reading black and white was also a little concerning because black and white film doesn't exist for 65 millimeter. I think our first challenge was starting to talk to Kodak if they could provide us with the necessary film stock that we needed for this film. They really started manufacturing stock very similar to the 5.2-2.2 35 millimeter stock. What I didn't really realize is that after we had that stock, there's this whole workflow after that that wasn't ready or non-existent in terms of, you know, workflow. We needed to re-engineer our cameras as well because those cameras, they have these pressure plates behind the film gates that are made out of metal, and the backing of the Kodak stock is much thinner than a color stock, and the light that would fall onto our stock would bleed back into the films, creating all these artifacts. And then there was the big conversation with Photochem, our lab. They had a workflow and they literally have one pipeline, one workflow, which is for color, which has never been for black and white. And then the question from us is, can you change that whole workflow into a black and white workflow? And if you can do it, how quick can you do it? So there was all these people that were helping us out and working on that singular thing of just us trying to shoot some frames, some black and white film.
So why go through all the hassle of a seemingly ancient process to get a black and white look when my video can look black and white with a tap of a button? Artists use a black and white filter or black and white film as a tool for multiple reasons. One, structure. This helps the viewer visualize a particular story structure or either a past and present point of view. This technique is used in Oppenheimer and Poor Things, and also in a more simple way in one of my favorite films, The Fugitive, in the opening where the audience sees a black and white murder of Dr. Richard Kimball's wife that he is wrongly accused for, a technique that's used in a lot of cop shows and drama shows that you see on television. Number two is timelessness. Because our modern brains still equate black and white film to the first half of the 20th century, using black and white immediately conveys a sense of history and prestige. Many of the most important moments in human history were captured in black and white. George Miller, director of the Mad Max franchise, said in an announcement about the black and white chrome release of Mad Max Fury Road that, quote, there's something about black and white film, the way it distills it, makes it a little bit more abstract. Something about losing some of the information of color somehow makes it more iconic. Miller also states that the chrome release is the best version of Mad Max Fury Road. Number three is tone. Black and white sets an environment for the audience, which is usually serious, muted, or mysterious. Horror director George A. Romero explained at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2012 that a week into filming Night of the Living Dead, they received an investment and had an opportunity to switch to color film and reshoot the first 7 days.
And I argued at the time that the most brutal scenes that I've ever seen, one of the most gory things is the image of Brando after they beat him up in On the Waterfront, and he's got blood all over him. And I felt that it was more gruesome, and I think that had something to do with news, because the news was all black and white at that time. There was no color TV yet, and I always felt that the black and white, the blood looked more real.
Parasite, the 2019 Oscar winner, was recently released in black and white. Director Bong Joon-ho said, I watched the black and white version twice now, and at times the film felt more like a fable and gave me the strange sense that I was watching a story from old times. The second time I watched it, the film felt more realistic and sharp, as if I was being cut like a blade. The number four reason artists use black and white is practical. Shooting in black and white removes the process of color grading and allows for objects like props and costumes to not appear fake, which is why so many indie filmmakers use black and white. Kevin Smith and Jason Mewes joke why their breakout hit Clerks was shot in black and white.
And you know, the reason is people think it's a creative choice. It was because there was no money, right?
That's right. Like,
I always had to say that because I don't want everyone thinking like, oh, he did it. It was creative and stuff.
That I was a real artist.
Yeah.
People, when they reviewed the movie, there was some critic a long time ago who said like, it's almost as if because it's black and white, the movie was shot from the perspective of the store security camera. And then every interview I did after that, I'd be like, we shot it in black and white because we wanted it to seem like it was shot from the store security camera.
And last, artists use black and white for simplicity. By removing color, there's less distraction and more focus can be placed on a performance, object, or light. This evokes a certain beauty. Here's Baumbach in the same interview with Criterion discussing the power of black and white. Quote, I had this feeling that we would celebrate the romance and energy and the spirit of New York City and being young and how good that can feel. So when we break down the effectiveness of the tool of black and white, the impact on an audience is powerful. That's why it's a technique that filmmakers continue to revert to. Even in this year's biggest movie, Dune Part 2, director Denis Villeneuve shot the arena scene in infrared to give it an even more harsh black and white look. And Netflix's new Talented Mr. Ripley remake, Ripley, starring Andrew Scott, is completely in black and white. But creators need to be cautious about using black and white because it's such an obvious choice. For every black and chrome release of Fury Road, there are probably hundreds of cop shows using black and white for flashbacks of a crime. And if used obviously, black and white can appear artsy or pretentious. It's the same reason why people judged you for using a black and white filter on your Instagram food posts in 2013. Director Christopher Nolan explains this quandary at a much more sophisticated level in an interview with Stephen Colbert.
When my wife, Evie, asked me afterwards what I thought about the choice to shoot some of it in color and some of it in black and white, I said, what are you talking about? What, like, how do you feel that I didn't notice?
I feel it's the perfect response because there's a danger. Anytime you stylize the image as a filmmaker, there's a danger that you remind the audience they're watching a film. Mm-hmm. For me, shooting on celluloid film, mixing color in black and white, which is something I'd done as far back as my film Memento, and I wanted to revisit that technique because I think it's a great way of making the audience feel differently about a scene, but not necessarily think about it too much. So it's a form of stylization that I think people are comfortable with. So it's great to hear that because I wanted it to roll by as more of a feeling than an idea, if you like.
style and feeling. That's what black and white film is all about. When Peter Bogdanovich was asked why he shot The Last Picture Show in black and white, he claimed that Orson Welles says every performance looks better in black and white. It's the fact that you don't see blue eyes and blonde hair. You focus on the performance, not the look of the people. While watching Orson Welles in The Third Man magically emerge from the darkness, I can say it definitely looks better in black and white. Least Important Things is a podcast about the most important of the least important things. It's hosted and created by me, Luke Ferris, executive produced by Jay Ferris, logo and brand design by Curtis Felton. You can interact and follow the show on social media at Luke H. Ferris on Instagram, at Least Important Things on TikTok. Visit our website, www.leastimportantthings.com. You can subscribe to our monthly newsletter, Least Important Things Monthly. Do that by going to the website or checking out the show notes. And this episode is actually on YouTube. We're trying out some new things on YouTube, so please subscribe to our YouTube channel, Least Important Things. And you can also reach out to me via email, leastimportantthings@gmail.com. And until next time, I'll talk to you soon.